Hello and welcome to On Sacred Ground on the LMC Radio Network on Blog Talk Radio, broadcasting the voices of the land and of the dead by weaving together history, ethnography, and spiritual experience. I'm your host, Kai Armand, and if you're tuning in online and having technical issues, remember that you can listen to this show, which is live, by calling in via your phone or Skype to 657-383-0525. To those of you who are listening live in the chat room at blogtalkradio.com, welcome and thank you so much for tuning in. This is our 28th episode of On Sacred Ground, broadcasting live at 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific, on this November 11th, 2015. As a Northeasterner living in New York, things are getting a little bit chilly up here, and I think that the topic today is really potent for that, as we are heading to the north of Europe, being joined by special guest Philip English of BitKeyArts.com. A little bit on Philip. Philip is an amazing young man who I am really privileged to call a friend, and a friend who lives in Brooklyn. I love hosting New Yorkers on this show because with as many people as we have here in the city, some people are really, really worth their salt, and Philip is one of them. A second-generation neo-pagan, Philip began his study of the Elder Futhark, runecraft, and Norse magic at the age of 9 under the tutelage of his father. Simply put, his praxis is that of the Vitki, or Norse magician. In his late teens, being obliged by Odin to pursue magical knowledge, he began an earnest study of the myriad streams of magical practice and spiritual philosophy throughout the world, paying close attention to Western Hermeticism, Gnosticism, and ceremonial magic. He is an initiate of Ordo Templi Orientis and the Blue Lodge degrees of Freemasonry. He has given lectures, talks, and classes on various topics, focusing on ritual magic, Norse magical traditions, spirituality in everyday life, the occult, and the history of the esoteric societies. As one of the co-founders of Catland Books here in Brooklyn, he has had the privilege of experiencing the legion that are the streams of magical practice as they manifest here in New York City, the crossroads of the world. His work has led him to learn from and interact with a wide variety of respected elders, authors, and authorities in the field, and he has earned a reputation as a highly talented rune reader and ritual performance artist. He is a proud member of a thriving metaphysical community of students and seekers after wisdom and seeks to facilitate his fellow aspirants in their pursuit of light. I am so excited to have Philip here to be talking about some things that I think are really important, not only in my own practice, but in the world at large, as we seek to understand what these traditions from various parts of the world mean when they come together and intermingle in the quote-unquote new world. So we're going to be getting into some really unique conversation today. But before that, as we do every episode, we'll be starting with a short sample from the book Earth Prayers from Around the World, 365 Prayers, Poems, and Invocations for Honoring the Earth. And this is a Chinook Psalter, which reads, Blessing of green plants, blessing of forests, cedar, Douglas fir, sword fern, salal bush, blessing of fish and birds, blessing of mammals, salmon, eagle, cougar, and mountain goat. May all humankind likewise offer blessing. Old woman, young woman, wise men and foolish. Blessing of youthfulness, blessing of children, big boys, little boys, big girls, and little ones. Bless the wisdom of the Holy One above us. Bless the truth of the Holy One beneath us. Bless the love of the Holy One within us. Without much further ado, Philip, are you there?
Hello, yes.
Welcome to the show. Thank you so much for joining me. Oh, God, we've been planning to have this for a while. I'm so grateful you're finally here.
Thank you so much for having me, and thank you for that beautiful poem. That was moving.
Oh, I wish I could have, you know, I wish I could take credit for it, alas.
I know, but I've heard it said before that the way you read poems, even if they're not by you, from other people is extra moving. You have a special voice, so.
Well, thank you. You know, I actually, the inspiration to read from this book came because I don't know if you've ever heard of Professor Charles Porterfield. He has a show that is just incredible. Mm-hmm. It's on the LMC radio network. And a portion of the show always focuses on a scripture. And he's just, oh, God, the man is a genius. And he's just deft with his application of scripture to conjure and everyday life. And I thought, wow, I need to have something that sets the tone of this show. And whenever I read from this book, it just sets that tone for me that no matter what we're discussing today, it's about all of us. It's about all of us and everyone, you know, the four-legged, the 18-legged, love them or not, you know, it's about all of us. So, Philip, there's so much to talk about, but let's start light. Let's start, you know, at zero before we go like 0 to 100. What's going on in your world? What's going on?
Well, I'm in Florida right now, and I'm having this strange sort of yearning for the North because we're going to be talking about runes, and you're talking about how cold it is, and it's actually 80 degrees here. And on one hand, I'm quite happy because I'm spending a bit of time in the winter down south. But on the other hand, my body and my soul are kind of going, what's going on? Where is winter?
You know, I first ran into that issue. I think it was watching the movie Home Alone when I was a child, and it's the idea that everyone's going to Florida for Christmas, and Macaulay Culkin is like whining and being like, "That doesn't make any sense. There's no Christmas trees down there." And I remember being a child and being like, "That doesn't make any sense. Like, what's Christmas? You know, what's Christmas and what's these holidays? You know, and this time of year without the cold." So you have my heart. I hope that you make it back to the freezing cold of New York by the time it really gets freezing cold.
Right. So I should be coming back immediately during the heart of winter, too. My return date is middle of January. So
oh, yeah.
It'll be,
you'll be here just
it'll be
in time.
A nice shock.
Yeah. So let's start with the most interesting, definitely not the most interesting, but the sort of a little bit more uncommon in our world today, maybe gaining a sort of commonness in the past 30 years, but before that, you know, before the neo-pagan movement really took off, not many people were being, you know, raised by adult neo-pagans as fathers. And you mentioned that in your bio that you were sort of taught the beginnings of Norse magic and working with the runes by your father.
Right. And that experience is this huge major part of my personal mythos, my biography, and it shapes every aspect of my spiritual worldview and my life in general, because I had both the blessing and the curse of being raised by my single father, who was, for lack of a better word, a Norse neo-pagan. And it's easy to take for granted what that means now in the age of the internet, because people are so educated, because you can just Google and see any source for any tradition you could ever want. Well, that's not true. There's some that aren't there, but many, many and most traditions you could ever want to find, you can get down to the sources and suss through like what there is and what there isn't that is valid. And my upbringing, my father began, I'm assuming, dabbling in Wicca and paganism and the occult in the late 70s. And so my upbringing was very, very influenced by a very Llewellyn style of paganism at a young age. And I had access, speaking of Llewellyn, rest in peace. But I had access to a whole plethora of books in my father's library, some really amazing and some really terrible, or some kind of laughable. Ed Fitch's Rights of Odin is a classic one that many people will make fun of because it has that classic Llewellyn book cover with like a buffed up airbrushed Odin. And
I'll take my Odin buff.
You know, Freya with a spear.
You'll find no argument here.
What?
I'll take my Odin buff. You'll find no argument here.
Yeah, that's the thing. I have a sort of a nostalgia for it, where a number of people are critical of that particular brand of Norse paganism. But that was my household growing up, and my dad had sort of like he kept the paganism on a down low a little bit when I was much younger, in his mind, to sort of protect me so that I wasn't going to school and alerting my Southern Baptist teachers. And then about the age of 9, he started introducing the runes, talking about them to me, and we started kind of doing basically rune tutoring. He would pull a rune and we would talk about it and we would divine with it and he would talk about its import. And so the runes and runic magic have been in my life since I can recall. And I can't conceive of a world without that being part of my personality.
You know, I love that we're talking about the, and yes, rest in peace, you know, Llewellyn, the founder of which the Llewellyn book publication empire recently passed away, almost single-handedly raising the empire and the mainstream understanding of neo-pagan traditions. There's so much that can be said about sort of, you know, quote-unquote Llewellyn brand of education around these topics. But I can also use the word nostalgia, and the word that was coming to my mind before you used that was that there's you're an artist and I'm an artist. There's a romanticism that would not have, that I think does stoke these traditions. There might be some misinformation, there might be certain lenses that really don't work, possibly even, you know, some historical inaccuracies, but a certain passion and romanticism with which these traditions, like the Norse tradition, were tended to by some of the earlier authors pre-internet to bring this information to the world. It's obviously, you know, wonderful that we are able to sort of fix the historical inaccuracies, find ourselves in a more factual understanding of these traditions as they existed before, but, and I know that that's part of what we're talking about today, it's not just about these traditions as they existed before, it is about the ingenuity and innovation of bringing these traditions into our time. And you can't do that without poetry. You can't do that without at least a hint of romantic idealism. You have to have some passion and fervency. You know, when I was raised Christian evangelical, so when I entered into neo-paganism, I kind of was like, okay, so, you know, I'm done converting people. What's on the menu today? You know, like, what are we aiming for? You know, what's the thing? And everyone was like, we're just you know, doing some Sabbats. And I was like, no, we have to have a thing, guys.
So what you're talking about brings to mind a memory of what was most likely my very first ritual that I ever did. And I tend to say that, you know, I came up under the tutelage of my father, but so much of my learning happened from sneaking books from his library and from his bookshelf and just going, oh, this is weird. Oh, Constantinos is summoning spirits. Let's get into this, right? But I just happened to be doing it at a very young, very naive age, and I have a lot of fond memories of that sort of, I was too young to be romantic, so that sort of naivety, magical naivety, creating a lot of like improv that now I'm both embarrassed of and kind of proud of myself. So I can recall the very first time I actually did sort of ritual magic, pulling out DJ Conway's Norse magic book, which is not based in any sense in any sort of historical tradition or accuracy in along the rubrics that we would normally judge what is accurately the magic of a peoples that we can look at their tradition by. And it had a ritual whereby you petition Freya to grant a wish of yours. And I remember it was talking about sticking your athame into the earth and speaking to Freya and asking her to grant your wishes. And I had no athame, so I used a butter knife. and I can recall like feeling both terrified and in awe and very silly in my backyard, sticking a butter knife into the ground and speaking to it. And I can't remember what the wish was, but it was something pretty banal. And I, if I'm not mistaken, it came true. but that kind of magic, I don't think should be erased. I don't think it should be removed, despite the fact that it's not legit or not elite.
Well, that's because, I mean, it's a part of growth. It's a part of the experience of, you know, you start, in the words of our dear friend, rapper Drake, started from the bottom, now you're here. You know, and that's what I think, because I'm thinking of my earliest rituals with, you know, covered cabinet cups and mugs. And that's fine. But obviously there's a finesse that can only grow with practice and with beginning to see the overlay between your experiences in ritual and your experiences outside of ritual. So you have this experience of being introduced to these spirits and this tradition and these traditions by your father, but then you yourself mm-hmm. experience your own sort of calling by the god Odin. I'd love if you could speak to that.
Yeah, so it takes a little bit of timeline. I'm a 9-year-old. I have a hippie Norse neo-pagan dad. I'm into that because it's really fun and cool, and it seems to make sense. But then I hit adolescence, and when it becomes time to rebel against your parents, I rebelled really hard. And the options for rebelling against a hippie who worships the Norse gods are pretty nil, because that normally is where teens go. So I got really into like dark death metal and like satanic black metal, and that didn't really faze him. So I became pretty materialist and never atheist, but just I became a pretty staunch agnostic and just sort of stepped away from spiritual things, right? And that was my rebellion. I just wanted nothing to do with this idea of magic because it was stupid and silly, and it was something my dad believed in. And then when I was about 19 years old, I was laying in my bed and started feeling funny sensations and started seeing funny things. And next thing I knew, I was seeing colors and lights and flashes of brilliance that I have difficulty recalling, and it almost make me tear up to recall what they looked like, because it was the most profound light I could ever imagine, or I don't even think I can imagine it. And some sort of knowledge came to me in that moment, because it was a little bit frightening at first, that this was in fact the Rainbow Bridge. And so before having this experience, the myths felt real, but they still had that sort of anthropomorphized mythic quality, where the Rainbow Bridge was literally a bridge that somebody walked on and was made of rainbows, and that's not real, right? But laying in my bed, having, I guess, what would be an out-of-body experience, I suddenly realized that I was being shown, for some reason, what the Rainbow Bridge was about, and it was, in fact, something more like a warp tunnel, right? Like a colorful warp tunnel. And next thing I know, I'm seeing God, like with a capital G. And words don't do it justice. I have this profound sense that I'm face to face with the big guy. And in fact, it turns out that I was face to face with what I now consider to be Heimdall, the sort of the guardian of the bridge, going, okay, we've taken you up. And then I was presented with what I can only call gnosis of Odin, the god, as in the real big deal, right? And I've tried to replicate that experience through ritual, through psychedelics when I was younger, right? Through a number of different means, and I've yet to feel that sense of sureness, of absolute utter knowledge that there was something divine in the universe. And the way that the divine presented itself to me was Odin and Heimdall, and I was kind of cast back into my body, and had this kind of like, well, what was that about, right? Why did I just have that experience other than, okay, well, now I know that there's something. And it began to kind of piece itself together. There was this message of, you've just seen your God. And I'm not saying one true God or only God, but just for me, I had just seen my God. And my God happens to be a lord of magic. And I felt this sense of mission that, by the fact of my birth, because I had been sort of incarnated into a magical household, and because I just had this intense experience that I wanted to replicate, I decided that I should go and seek out wisdom to learn as much as I could about the arts magical, to pick these things up. And I was a young man at that time. I was 19 at that time. At that time, some of my inclinations can now be looked at as appropriative, because I was like, I'm going to go to every single culture of the world and learn everything about their magic and take it and use it for myself. I've grown out of that sort of mentality, but that was the aim, right? That was the sort of mission. And I also immediately started speaking to psychologists and psychiatrists to make sure that I was not schizophrenic. That's something I put out there a lot, because that sounds crazy, right? And every therapist I've spoken to, you know, they run me through the checks and the tests, and they're like, well, that might be an eccentric notion, but you're functional, and we can't give you a diagnosis. And that's that. That was the experience, and I've been on my merry way since then. That was now 11 years ago.
I'm sorry. Excuse me if I'm wrong. 11 years ago?
Yeah, I'm.
Oh,
I'm,
you know,
sorry.
I think I. You, oh, you said that this took place when you were 19.
Yeah.
I thought that you said that you when you were 9, and I'm thinking, oh my God, you were so much younger than I thought you were.
No, that's well, that sounds very badass, but no, I started. You know, the significance is not lost on me, and I don't know if it was intentional for my dad. I get so Southern when I say that, my dad. I've been in the South for a little bit, and my accent, which I've tried very hard to kind of gloss over, comes back in weird ways. I started practicing runes, studying runes when I was 9, and really started actually looking at them in earnest when I was 11 or 12. And even during my agnostic period, in times of stress or sort of minor emergencies, despite the fact that I was like, this is stupid and I don't believe in it, I would chant runes when the shit hit the fan, so to speak.
Oh, of course, you know, practice of faith, and as anyone, you know, would do, really. Going back to those earliest sort of comfort prayers and comfort ways of knowing from family of origin space. So how would you relate your current practice to the traditions of Asatruar and hedonism?
That's a great question. In the last, I'd say about 2 years, I've had sort of an identity crisis and what I consider a crisis of community, in that growing up, I can recall really longing for engaging with what I now know is the Ace of True community. I wanted other people who believed as I did, and I wanted to have fellowship with them. And over the last decade, I've had some interactions with what, for lack of a better word, I'll call organized Ace of True, right? This can be a contentious word, but the religion itself, Ace of True, or organizations that gather people together in fellowship. And I've never felt at home with any of those organizations. That's not to say that they're somehow bad or invalid. That being said, I have bumped into a few organizations that actually are, actually have beliefs that I find abhorrent, particularly the Volkish side of things. But even the ones that I don't, you know, disagree with politically, seem to be based around that community aspect, which on one hand I long for, but on the other hand, my practice is very focused on actual magical and mystical practice and real operative stuff. So there is a sense of being sort of outside of the organizational structure. And I think that this is connected to that the archetype of Odin as the wanderer, right? He's connected to tribes, of course, but the I suppose, if I may take a loan word for a moment, the path of Odin that I relate to the most is a wandering path. And there is a sense of reconstructing the religion, Ace of True, in America, along lines that, to me, I sometimes feel are sort of influenced by this notion of wanting to be recognized as a major faith, like the monotheistic faiths are recognized. So, you know, codifying the Nine Noble Virtues, right? Having a sort of an equivalent to the Ten Commandments. That's a recent invention, and it's not something that really speaks to me. So I don't really, I think all of those virtues are fantastic in themselves, but I don't feel the need to have a cultural structure where I go, oh, I believe this, and I have nine ideals that I adhere to that are codified and were written down in the 1970s, and that's my rule and guide. That being said, I'm quite fond of what's going on in Iceland they're building a temple that's recognized, right? And they have all these great viral news stories online about the government recognition of this heathen temple with the fellowship over there. And I think it's spearheaded by Orn Hilmarsson, who is a successor of Svanbjorn Bentjensen. And if any Scandinavians are listening, they'll probably be really upset with my pronunciation. I am an American, and anytime I speak to somebody from Scandinavia and try my best to, no matter what, they'll tell me I'm wrong, and I will repeat their pronunciation as perfectly as I can, and they'll still tell me I'm not saying it right. But
we do our best.
Svanbjorn Bentjensen, yeah, Svanbjorn Bentjensen was an Icelandic poet and farmer who was very prolific in the 70s and early 80s. And he really got the ball started on that revival of Ace of True. And I think he was one of, we could consider him probably the founder of modern Ace of True. And his vibe, their style, I like it a lot. But I'm not in Iceland, and so I can't really engage with them much.
So, in a way, you're saying that some of the denominations, to use a word that Ms. Cat Iron would just use in the chat room, of Ace of True really aren't your flavor, especially the ones that are in America. But the sort of tone that's being hit in Iceland is sort of more along your lines. But you wouldn't necessarily call yourself even a member of Ace of True. You seem to the term Vitki for you really serves what your work looks like, even though obviously there's a sharing of the same pantheon, you know, a relationship with, you know, language and runes that is similar.
Right. So Vitki became the thing I've settled into, because I'm primarily a magician, and my work, my aim is to work magic primarily through ritual or chanting, song, things we could consider shamanistic work. And when we get into the modern reconception of the Norse tradition, there are all of these terms and labels that now are being placed onto a tradition that we're not even sure if linguistically these things are correct. So there's this idea of the gender difference between Galdr and Sidr, which, for listeners who aren't familiar, Galdr is traditionally considered sort of men's magic, and Sidr is considered women's magic, and Sidr is sort of more inward-based, shamanically oriented, whereas Galdr is the use of signs or songs to affect change. And these notions are coming from sources that were written primarily by Christians, and sort of within that concept, there's this idea that you'll see often online of ergi, which is unmanliness, and this idea that Odin learned Sidr from Freya and took upon himself this ergi, this unmanliness, by doing women's magic, and therefore male practitioners of this magic, they're also have this kind of unmanliness to them, which I'm okay with bearing that, right? I'm not particularly dysphoric about my gender, but that notion, it doesn't pass a smell test for me as being authentic, because it's getting filtered through the internet, through sources that were alive 300, 400 years after that culture had already been suppressed by Christianity. And so Vitki is just an Old Norse word for wise man or sorcerer, and it doesn't come with the debate about, you know, what is good, what exactly are you practicing. There's a little bit of a branding issue there, right? Because I consider myself a magician. I work with runes primarily. I practice what I would call Sidr. And then I also am quite fond of Western ceremonial magic, right? The stuff that looks a lot like Golden Dawn work and even Christian mysticism. And I find it compatible with my work. So I just use that word as opposed to any other.
And if I'm not mistaken, you're not entirely alone. You know, both the notable figures of Raven Caldera and Galina Kraskova come to mind as individuals who are working in sort of northern traditions, but sort of preface their work and themselves by their work versus attachment to either of these communities. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong.
What is the? I'm sorry, I don't understand. So it was a question.
I was just saying that I believe Galina Kraskova and Raven Caldera, they both sort of work in northern tradition shamanism. So, like you, they're working with the same pantheon. Obviously, the runes play a strong role in their work. But that neither of them are particularly aligned with the Asa True community or the heathen community.
Right.
And it's like their work versus the identity sort of
right.
comes before.
Fantastic, yeah, yeah. I'm more familiar with Galina's work than I am with Raven's, though I, of course, I'm familiar with the names. But I also have to point out, I think somebody mentioned this on the chat room, I'm not able to follow along and talk at the same time, I'm finding, but you know, there's a polyvocality thing going on with different people that make up the Asa True community. And it's so funny because here we have a subsect of, if we look at modern neo-paganism, we have like a subsect with many, many subsects within it. And I've just found in my experience, some of them I get on with and some of them I don't. But I don't feel served. And this is just my personal preference, right? I don't want to start any flame wars on the internet because I think some people can be served and it's a beautiful thing. But I don't feel served by the community function of the Asa True organizations I've come into contact with, or even enclaves of people who aren't, that don't have like a name, but are just kind of gathered together as Asa True practitioners. I'll give you an example, maybe, and this will probably spell it out a little bit better than just me talking about, this is how I feel, right? When I do blot, when I drink from a drinking cup, when I drink mead and I praise the gods, or I say an inspired poem, or I make an oath, I like to do that when the spirit moves me. I like to do it intuitively, and it's usually impromptu, and I will drink mead and whatever flows out is what flows out, and that feels right to me spiritually. And what I've done when I've been amongst more formalized Isitrar is the standard, you pass around the cup, okay, the first round we're going to praise the ancestors or praise a god. The second round, we're going to do swear an oath or make a brag. And then the third round, we're going to do X, Y, or Z. And that, it seems valid, right? I'm not calling it invalid, but it just doesn't work the same way for me. And I don't feel it as much. And so I feel a little bit out of place when I'm doing that.
So in a way, you're in really indeed, you know, on the wanderer's path of Odin. You know, for me, I'm often talking about Odin in the same conversation as Jesus when I am reading cards, tarot cards, and I come across the Hanged Man card and this sort of sacrificial figure who's really putting himself out there. I mean, putting himself out there is a understatement, but really, you know, separating himself from the flock and the people to do something that's never been done before.
Right.
You know, a tremendous sacrifice for the greater good. And, you know, obviously, I guess as we're having this conversation, I'm thinking about the ways in which that, you know, manifests in the lives of followers and sometimes not, you know, manifesting in the lives of followers. But, you know, I'm really, really excited to get to your own practice then, what your practice does consist of, and who you serve in terms of your practice here in Brooklyn, when you're here in Brooklyn, as well as, you know, I feel like there's an element of needing to talk a little bit more about the figure of Odin. I don't think that you can separate, or at least I've been told that you can't separate the runes from Odin. So we'll be getting to that right after this short break, the short musical break, and I definitely want to also have a quick talk about the selection that you provided us with. So thank you so much for being here.
Okay, thank you.
Sandinam Elegapter Sadam. Imbuljognionam Ekafinum Freios in Iberkors Beslofer. Och en tryck av gatins dyra mjadar av sin ådre. Han har mig krävast och fråder vera och vaxa och välhavas.
We are back in On Sacred Ground. I'm Kai Armand, and we are here with special guest Philip English discussing the runes, Odin, and his work as a Vitki, or Norse magician. In our last segment, we were discussing ever so slightly the figure of Odin, the Allfather in Norse tradition, whether that be in the various neo-pagan, contemporary neo-pagan traditions thereof, or among solitary practitioners like Philip. Philip, could you speak a bit? I know that, you know, obviously tomes and tomes and volumes have been written about Odin, but I'd love to know if you could at least provide for our listeners a bit of a background on this figure.
So it's really hard to find a starting place, so I won't start at the beginning, but I will start at the part that's the most juicy for me, the most interesting part about Odin's story. We have Odin, who is the the All-Father, the you know, if you want to make the comparison to the Zeus or the Jupiter, the dad god who's in charge of things. And this particular god has a relentless thirst for wisdom and wants more and more and more and wants to just continuously expand in knowledge and wisdom and also power. It would be a lie if I didn't, you know, consider this to be a power-hungry god. And we have the story of Odin winning the runes, and that was actually the song you were just playing is from the Havamal, and that was the section is Odin's rune poem. And the thing that's really juicy to me about this story, the thing that's really resonant, is that we have a god who is ostensibly some sort of creator. It's debatable about how much he created, but he's in charge of things and is the progenitor to some extent. And he wants more wisdom and has what I consider an existential crisis in that he feels his attainment and wants more and wonders, how do I get more? How do I get wisdom? And he comes to the conclusion that he will do what man does. what man does when they want wisdom is they sacrifice to Odin, right? And so Odin, being Odin, chooses to ritualistically sacrifice himself to himself. He's the god he has to sacrifice to. This to me implies this question of, is there something beyond me, right? It's as though Odin is going, okay, well, what else is there? What is beyond me, a god? And how do I attain that? And so I will do the same ritual that man does. So he hangs himself from a tree for 9 nights and 9 days, and that tree happens to be the world tree, Yggdrasil. And on the 9th night, he falls screaming into what is essentially the abyss, and somehow returns armed with the runes. The runes are what he sees outside of the world tree after this ritual. Maria Vilhaug, who studied at, I believe, the University of Oslo and did her master's thesis, it's called The Maiden with Mead. It's available online as a PDF. Speculates that within this is within the story, there is a hint at initiatic cults, right? That this is a way of emulating Odin, and Odin is the Hierophant and Psychopomp of that particular path of winning the runes through self-sacrifice. But it's remarkable to me, the story, and I don't know many like it from other cultures, that you would have a god do the ritual of the god to the god. This is going to out me as a nerd, but in computer science, the equivalent would be a recursive function. The function of Odin calls himself, his own function, upon himself. And that's just fascinating. I think it's really interesting. After this, he becomes, you know, the rune master. And the runes, which are the foundation of my universe, are something more than just the letters of the Old Norse alphabet, right? That's what we've come to see them as. They're the angular letters that make up the various futharks, the Elder Futhark being the most popular. But in Old Norse, rune has this kind of quality like aloha, in that rune can mean letter, but it can also be song or secret or mystery. There's the verb to rune, which means to whisper. And when we use the word rune magic, I think that Odin's rune magic, and ideally mine, is something greater than just the Old Norse alphabet. That it is a magical practice that looks at the phenomena of another word for a rune is song. So the phenomena of songs, or these encapsulated these encapsulated bits of existence, right? These forces that we can give names to.
And I've also, you know, it's also been told to me that the runes are not just symbols, but and I don't know if you take this same view, but that the runes themselves are also sort of sentient beings.
Right. So I go back and forth on this because in my work with the runes, there are times when they seem like vast, impersonal forces. And then there are other times when they seem like spirits that have personalities and will talk to you. And it seems as though that they like to change their qualities based on what lesson needs to be taught. I believe, and I think we're getting to the crux of what has become the focus of my work. I teach classes, and I like to teach students my practice, which is developing relationships with the runes. So I believe that the runes themselves are teaching devices in the sense that they will teach you. You develop a relationship with them, and they will teach you what they are about and how to use them or how to work with them. And sometimes, you know, why you should stay away from them. So there are times when they seem like vast impersonal forces, and there are other times when they seem like personalities. And thankfully, it's not science, so it's magic, and I can vacillate between the two.
Absolutely, holding, you know, the possibility of opposing worldviews in one hand. So what would you say to someone who wanted to, because often people, you know, aren't thinking about the runes as teaching tools or spirits. They're usually thinking about them as a divinatory tool, and I imagine that that's at least one component, if not, you know, a primary component of your practice as a Vidki is working with the runes as a divinatory tool. What would you say to someone who has no background in working with the runes but feels something stirring or feels pulled toward working with them? What would you say to that person in that relationship?
So it's interesting because we live in a time when magic is very popular, right? When it's being – every day I see more and more sort of like viral news articles about the notion of like being a witch or a wizard or what have you. And it's very profitable as somebody who's been in magical business, right, who has sold, you know, spiritual goods out of a store. It's very good for business to say this is for everybody and everybody can do it and it's completely safe. And I would be doing a disservice to my practice and to the world at large if I didn't say that runes can be intense if you use them. They're big forces. And so I don't want to dissuade anybody from engaging with them, but I would say before throwing out a rune, right, before just diving in, research the nature of the specific rune you're wanting to work with very, very deeply before jotting it down on something. Because part of the power of the runes, part of their efficacy, is that they call forth very big forces, and one can recognize immediate effects. But if you don't know what you're getting into, those effects can be sometimes disastrous. And I've had to learn hard lessons over and over again because of the runes. It's not a simple, easy path. It's not making a vision board, right? it can be intense. So I recommend always reading and studying as much as possible before engaging with a rune or runes. And if you're lucky enough to find somebody who's actually wise and knows what they're doing, to ask elders for advice, to ask people who have learned from the kinds of mistakes that I've had to learn from for advice. And I'm continuously experiencing new dimensions, new elements of the runes and what they're about. And the quality of a runic sort of teaching experience, by which I mean when a rune kind of presents itself to me and teaches me, it's like nothing else, in that suddenly, let's say one example, Gibo, we have gift, mutual exchange, right? I had sort of a time when something was stolen from me, and the people who stole it from me happened to have accidentally left behind their wallet with their ID in it, right? This became this huge something to me sensed that this was a Gibo experience, that its nature was of Gibo, right? That's a more benign one, in that I thankfully got to have my stuff back, and it was an activation of that force. But there are rooms that their energies are chaotic, that are fiery. And I recommend that somebody must begin just working with runes. First of all, they're operative in many ways. You can chant their name. You can place them on things. You can draw them on something, right? You can project them. To start thinking about tempering them, working on bind runes, that is to say the combination of different runes, so that you're getting a more diffused energy, so that it's not just ice, right? And that is a certain quality to runes that you don't see in divination systems like tarot. Because tarot, we have this mixture of elements. I guess maybe the aces might be equivalent, but we have, you know, fire of water and earth of air and so on and so forth. Whereas if you pull Issa in a rune reading, it means ice and everything that is icy and everything that is cosmic ice, and also the ice cube in your ice tray. There's no differentiation. And so to use that operatively, you're calling forth ice and you might not necessarily know how to temper it. That being said, I think one of the things that makes a good runic diviner is the ability to pull those runes and see those big things and have either the relationship with the rune to know what it's telling you, or to have the discernment to know, you know, is this cosmic ice, or is this ice in the ice cube, or is this ice on the ground that you're going to slip and fall?
Absolutely. And I love the word discernment. It's a word I use a lot on this show. And discernment as a diviner is necessary, so necessary, to be able to discern between those sort of different levels of understanding and meaning. I'd love to, you know, you mentioned the word appropriation earlier. And
right.
I'd love to sort of run the idea by you of someone who is not of Nordic culture, of any Nordic culture, finding themselves pulled toward working with the runes.
Right. Well, here's the thing. And you actually may be more educated than I am in this respect. I am not certain if you can appropriate from a culture that hasn't been colonized. When I think appropriation, I think people going to cultures that have already suffered colonialization and going, thank you, I will take this for me, right? The Northern European culture has not suffered colonization in that same sense. If somebody's listening and they know their history better than I might be get called out, and I'm open to that. Furthermore, my tradition doesn't have, to my knowledge, an existing closed priesthood. And when the closest sort of objection I would see would be that sort of like the Volkish objection, that your ancestors didn't practice this, therefore you're not able to tap into it. And the thing that's confusing to me, and always has been, and this may sound, you know, with all humility, this may sound like it's coming from a place of ignorance, but if we're going to admit that these are gods, like with a capital G, then are we going to go all out and say that they're gods on that cosmic sense, that they're big and vast? Or are we going to say that these are the gods of a specific race that's tied to a specific region in Northern Europe? Right? And to me, my gods are vast, right? The runes are universal. I've seen, you know, online the term universalist used as a pejorative, right? Like, oh, they're a universalist. They're watering down the tradition. And yet the runes are inherent in everything in my worldview. I see them, right? That they're in, they exist in the trees, and it sounds like I'm about to quote The Craft, right? They're in the trees, they're in the air, they're everywhere. So how can you appropriate, like, what's that?
Or you're about to quote Pocahontas, one or the other.
Or what's like, how can you appropriate leaves? How can you appropriate ice? these things, of course, this is, I have primarily Northern European heritage. I feel a connection to it. But it doesn't feel like a closed connection. It doesn't feel like a club that only I'm allowed in.
Is there a rune that has especially deep meaning for you, or a rune that sort of stands out when you think about your past with them and any anecdotes?
Yeah, sure. Inglas is a particularly meaningful rune to me. My name is Philip English, and the name English is connected to etymologically, it's connected to a Scandinavian tribe called the Englings, who evidently in ancient Northern Europe, if you needed to be a king, you also had to claim, you know, sort of divine kingship. So every single tribe has, like, Odin as their patriarch. And the one that my name comes from is also associated with Freyr, who the name Freyr is an epithet, which means Lord, and the sort of like the real name of the god is Inglas, who is a sort of lord of fertility and the masculine counterpart and brother of Freya in the basic sort of lore. So I feel just by name, of course, you know, who knows where that name comes from and where that goes in your ancestry, but it just kind of speaks to me when I see it. It kind of reminds me of ancestor work, and it feels kind of like home as a rune, right? And it's one I resonate with a lot. But there's others too. I feel like I have to give like almost a shout out to what is alternately pronounced Algiz, Algir, or Elhaz, because this is it's imported as elk, but it's very much a shielding rune, and it's saved my skin a number of times. So I feel like I might as well publicly praise it as well.
Well, we're going to go to your next musical selection that you provided us with. And when we return, we're going to hear a bit more about that particular selection, as well as get a bit deeper into your practice and see what else you do, again, relating to the people that you serve. And I know that Brooklyn, because we are both in this landscape, is a very uniquely changing landscape when it comes to spirituality. And I look forward to hearing your thoughts on that as someone who was really a prime mover and shaker in the Brooklyn spirituality landscape as it's becoming today. So we'll be right back.
Thank you. glögelvarken och trä. Mina gäster går i skogen, glögelvarken och trä. Tridiralla, så blir du dig, tridiralla, så blir du. Våra piger och våra drängar sätta knä mot knä. Tridiralla, så blir du dig, tridiralla, så blir du. Våra piger och våra drängar sätta knä mot knä. Mina gäster går i skogen, sätta knä mot knä. Mina gäster går i skogen, sätta knä mot knä. Tridiralla, så blir du dig, tridiralla, så blir du. Våra piger och våra drängar knaga barken av trä. Tridiralla, så blir du dig, tridiralla, så blir du. Våra piger och våra drängar knaga barken av trä.
Listening to the LMC Radio Network, whose art and information may be found on its webcast shows. The LMC Radio Network is a community radio alliance of metaphysical, spiritual, inspirational, and political justice broadcasters spanning a wide range of topics. Tune in Sundays for the Lucky Mojo Hoodoo Rootwork Hour, hosted by Catherine Ironwood and Conjurman Ali. It features panel discussions on traditional African-American hoodoo spellcasting with members of the Association of Independent Readers and Rootworkers, plus free readings and magical rootwork advice for live call-in clients. The longest-running conjure show in the universe, it may be heard from 3 o'clock to 4:30 Pacific Time, Sunday afternoons. On Mondays, get ready for Candelo's Corner, starring Candelo Cambisa. This is the meeting place for all esoteric traditions. Candelo brings his insight as a Polero and eclectic spiritualist to his interviews with peers in Afro-Caribbean lineages, as well as representatives of numerous other spiritualities and religions. You can hear Candelo's Corner Monday evenings from 5 to 7 Pacific Time. Tuesdays feature two wonderful shows to suit your taste. On the Crystal Silence League Hour, John St. Germain provides spiritual guidance and tips on the practical use of crystals and crystal balls. His show starts at 5 p.m. Pacific Time and lasts for 1 hour. Next is In the Streets with Beverly Smith. Beverly provides up-to-the-minute reports on civil and social rights issues. Her one-hour show airs on Tuesday evenings at 6 p.m. Pacific Time. On Wednesday nights, Kai Armand broadcasts On Sacred Ground, a tapestry of our times comprising history, ethnography, and shamanism, featuring the voices of the land and the deceased, aided by scholars, spirit workers, and environmentalists. Kai's show airs from 5 to 7 Pacific Time. On Thursdays, it's the Now You Know Show with Professor Porterfield. In a variety show laced with country wit and biblical wisdom, the professor shares his knowledge of roots, delivers the lucky numbers, and explores the secrets of scriptural sorcery. From 6 to 7:30 p.m. Pacific Time, there's no end to the surprises. And on Saturday nights, come out and join Liquid Libations. Andrea Weston hosts this informal sharing and showcasing of poetry, short stories, and spoken word performances contributed by novices and professional wordsmiths. Call in and read your work. Liquid Libations may be heard on Saturday nights from 5 to 7 p.m. Pacific Time. All shows on the LMC Radio Network are sponsored by the Lucky Mojo Curio Company, located in Forestville, California, and online at luckymojo.com. Add 3 hours for Eastern, tax and license may apply, train departure times and Burma shave signs subject to change without notice. LMC.
Lucky Mojo Curio Company is based in sunny Forestville, California, and provides traditional spiritual products for remediating all kinds of conditions. Locate them online at luckymojo.com or visit them in person to see the world's smallest church, Missionary Independent Spiritual. I'm Kai Armand, and you're back on Sacred Ground with special guest Philip English of VitkeyArts.com. We are discussing Norse magic, the runes, and the Norse god Odin. Philip, are you there?
I'm here.
In our last segment, I mentioned that you were a prime mover and shaker in the sort of quote-unquote occult revival, as many news outlets have called it, in Brooklyn, and that is through your having founded the occult store Catland, which I know you are no longer affiliated with, but I know that that was a very big part of your sort of growing into your work as a sort of public, if you don't mind using the terms, sort of a public priest, a public servant of the public with your skills as a magic worker and diviner. What are some of the other services that you offer to the public aside from divination?
Aside from divination? It's really on a case-by-case basis. I'm trying to find a good word for it because everything involves divination. If I'm going to be doing, for lack of a better word, we call ritual services, it has to start with divination for me to understand what needs to be done, for me to prescribe what kind of work we're doing. I have a service that I offer through my Mibaza shop, which is accessible at VickyArts.com, which involves divination, but I also do what we can call journeying. I call it Seether, to the Norse cosmos, to each of the realms of Yggdrasil. And this is kind of like a soul mapping. If a client wants to really go deep into what's going on in what we would call their Orlag, their I'm trying to think of a good translation, their something kind of like karma. Karma is a weak translation, but it works. I will go and use runes as a way of entering into a trance state and journey and divine what's happening in various zones within what is my magical cosmos. And if somebody shares it or somebody's interested in exploring that, then it can be beneficial. I also have no qualms against performing Galdr on for hire. I don't have the same sort of taboos against selling my trade, right, that some people will. So I will do effective magic. Within reason, I have things I won't do, obviously, very negative things. And I actually saw a phrase on, I believe, a hoodoo practitioner's website that says, "I don't do reconciliation work." And I think I'm going to add that to my to my verbiage now, because that's something that's been asked of me a lot that never really feels right. What I really like to do is to coach people on their own rituals. If somebody's kind of wanting to learn a bit about constructing ritual, I like to educate. And I also really enjoy giving classes. It's something that as opposed to the divination, which feels like something I have to do, just spiritually, and which is to say, it feels like it's necessary to my path, and the magical work, which sometimes I feel compelled to do, and other times I feel like this is what I must do to continue to be a full-time magician in a capitalist society. The teaching is really where I feel very fulfilled. I feel very happy because I have students that will come to me and they want to learn what I know about the runes or my way of getting to know the runes and working with the runes and other things. I will teach some of the more Western stuff too. I have a course I like to teach looking at workshopping the actual techniques of of ritual magic. So not just like banishings, but consecration and purification and those kinds of things. And that, I think, more and more is the service I will be offering. Is, you know, so long as there's people that are interested in taking classes, I'll be putting them on.
Well, I think education is of tremendous importance, especially in the changing climate, where, as you mentioned, every week we have a new article coming out about witches and magic, and people are obviously
Right. Absolutely
seeking, you know, real knowledge. Well, some people are, and you're definitely
Yeah. One
of the people who's able to deliver that. The last musical selection that you provided, what was that?
So that was a koning, and a koning is, of course, that was a modernized sort of rendition and studio recording, but that was a Swedish herding calls, and those traditionally are what usually women would sing to bring their livestock down from the from hills and mountains when it was time to bring them home after they've been grazing, and there's actually some speculation that somehow konings were sung before livestock was domesticated in Scandinavia, and that the konings, and this is not like a magical discussion, this is some sort of anthropological discussion, that the konings helped foster the domestication of livestock. And to me, that is really a fantastic example of a real life magical song, right? This isn't just you sing a song and you feel that you've sung it and you've changed your vibe, which is valid and good too. But this is, you've literally sung a song and the livestock hear it and they come down from the hill.
Which just reminds me of, you know, the practical applications that we see in so many forms of folk magic and ritual, that there's always, you know, so often a practical aspect to what's playing out. I'll never forget reading an anthropological anecdote about an anthropologist in another culture who was talking about people putting out food for the nature spirits and land spirits outside their home, sort of just outside their house. And he was at first appalled looking at the food outside of the house, and he would say, "You guys, you put out these offerings for your spirits, and they become covered with ants, and, you know, small animals come and get them. Don't you realize?" And then he stopped himself and said, "Oh, this keeps those animals and insects from coming inside the house." Wow.
Yeah. Wow. That's great.
Well, it's so wonderful
fantastic.
Having you here. Again, this has been Philip English of Vitke, and you can find him and his work at vitkearts.com. I'm so glad that we finally were able to have you on the show and talk about this deep information. You can expect a call from me in the next, like, 20 minutes, because I have personal room things to talk to you about in my own very, very strange universe.
I can't wait to talk
very
about
strange,
it.
Very strange, but always blessed. So again, this has been Philip English of VitkeArts.com. Go pay him a visit, and I know that he's going to be doing some really amazing things, especially here in New York in the upcoming year. This has been another episode of On Sacred Ground with your host, Kai Arman. Tune in next week as we continue to go deep into the heart of the human experience, in which place plays a primary role. Until then, keep a light in your window for courage in our times. I'll be keeping a light in mine. Thanks again, Philip.
Thank you.
lend a helping hand.